We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a podcast all about Millennium. Soylent Green is people. I'm Darren Mooney, I'm guest hosting this week, and joining me is the wonderful and incomparable Chris Knowles. How are you, Chris?
My God, it's full of stars.
How are things?
They're good. It's a beautiful day here today. It's the weather here has been superlative. Very un-millenniumistic.
No rain pouring down as you listen to How Deep Is Your Love in a Car, no?
No, sir. When I listen to How Deep Is Your Love in a Car, it's beautiful and sunny and breezy and butterflies just flitting around. It's lovely out. And I'm not killing anybody.
That is also a plus. I find that makes days a lot easier. What was I say? But yeah, so Chris, this is actually, we've both done the X-Cast before. I believe this is your first time on The Time Is Now. So I'm very glad to have the sort of opportunity to introduce you, first of all. But also to ask you the five questions that we have, that we ask sort of every guest as they come on. And, you know, you've done the X-Cast before, so I have a sneaking suspicion you know what these five questions are.
I do indeed, and I've been listening religiously to The Time Is Now, so I'm, you know, loaded for bear.
You're well prepared. We have notes. Perfect. Well, then we'll ask the five questions. You can imagine yourself in a little circle with questions being fired at you by versions of me in silhouette sitting in chairs as a grab bag. Here we go. All right, so question number one. Chris, when did you first discover Millennium?
Well, I had heard about it as soon as it was announced, you know, because I was a deep and mentally sick X-Files obsessive from day one, from before day one, from, you know, when I first saw the promos. I'm like, okay, that's the show I'm going to become pathologically obsessed on. And of course, here we are 26 years later, and such is the truth. But yeah, as soon as this was announced, I was ready for it, but I was also deeply worried and resentful, and we can explore that depth.
Is that something we can get to in the episode, or do you want to sort of unpack that now?
You're the host, so it's your call.
Okay, let's unpack that a little bit now. Why were you sort of, what was the wariness? What were you sort of worried about?
I was afraid that it was going to split Chris Carter's attention away from the X-Files and hurt the show, and I think it did. I think it hurt the show. I think Millennium hurt the X-Files in many, many ways. You know, I mean, that's not a qualitative statement on Millennium because here I am and I've watched all the episodes of Millennium several times and so on and so forth. But I was very worried. I felt, you know, it's kind of like, you know, your dad tells you that he's, you know, divorcing your mom to go live with a secretary, you know, that kind of deal. I just felt like, don't go, daddy. You know, I just felt very possessive of his attention. And I think that the split in his attention, you know, especially the fact that he took on the movie at the same time, I think the movie would have been far better had he not been so concerned with Millennium. You know, I mean, it's just crazy to run two full, you know, especially the way that we know he worked.
Yeah.
And, you know, the amount of attention and detail that he put into his shows, to do that and then to try to write a script. And I think, you know, the real casualty, I think that season four of X-Files is problematic for me. Season, you know, Millennium on the whole is problematic for me. But I think that Fight the Future really suffered. And I think Fight the Future would have been a much better movie had he been able to spend the time that he spent on, say, like the pilot.
Which he famously went back and reshot sequences of and all that sort of stuff as well. And obviously the amount of time and effort that goes into making a pilot in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was very much an X-Files loyalist. And then I sort of started to notice that a bunch of people became like, oh, well, you know, X-Files is old hat. X-Files is over. Millennium's where it's at. And I was like, no, don't you dare say that. You know, like this is kind of stupid fanboy online crap, you know. But yeah,
even
I mean,
back in 96.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, I think I've made mention of this on the show before, but, you know, Glenn Morgan had talked about how, like, when X-File, all TV X-Files, you know, first popped up on Usenet, that they were all sort of watching it. And, you know, and Glenn Morgan said that he felt that it had gone toxic rather quickly. And he said that after one breath, he said he stopped reading.
Just sort of on that as well, if you were a fan from, well, as in like, maybe not a fan, but you were paying attention to Millennium from day one, maybe it took a little bit longer for you to kind of get used to Daddy's life with the secretary, so to speak. But were you there for the sort of the initial hype around it? The stuff where I think they screened the pilot in cinemas in certain places as well. Were you around for that sort of stuff? For the
Well, I didn't attend the screenings. I wasn't invited. But yeah, I was. Yeah, you couldn't avoid it. It was the hype machine was relentless. I mean, Fox is very, very good at that kind of thing. And they really, you know, I mean, I think it had the highest ratings of anything that's ever aired on Fox. Yeah. I mean, the ratings were tremendous. But here's the interesting thing about that as well, is that I would watch X-Files with my wife and we started to watch Millennium together. And it's interesting too, because she loved like stuff like Silence of the Lambs, and she read a lot of like serial killer books, and she was really into that kind of thing. So I thought she'd really enjoy the show, and she thought she really would too. And after Gehenna, she said, I can't watch this. This is too intense. And then we skipped a few episodes. And then we watched 522666 together, and she's just like, forget it. I can't watch this. This is
too much.
This is just too. And I think a lot of people had that reaction, you know, particularly women. I think that a lot of people, you know, particularly since so many of the stories are sort of violence against women, but not as much as you might think, which is rather interesting. It seems that young men were sort of got their equal share of punishment on the first season of Millennium. She just felt that it was too intense and too stressful. Yeah. You know, even in the context of television today, it's still pretty tough medicine to take. It's not a fun show to watch. It's a show that I greatly admire, but I don't know if I love. And the reason being is that it's a show that doesn't want to be loved. It's very confrontational. It's very abrasive. And it's a kind of show that doesn't want you to sit back and feel comfortable. It's really wants you to be uncomfortable, I think.
It's very, very prickly. I mean, the famous story about the Fox censor who went through frame by frame those Millennium flashes and said, okay, there's nothing in here that we would have any issue airing, went home, fell asleep, came in the following morning and said, that gave me nightmares. You can't do that. And Carter saying, well, it's too late. You already gave us approval for it. There is a weird intensity, and it is very prickly, and particularly the first season, where there's a lot of craft and attention to detail there. But you're right, it's not an easy watch, and it sits with you. And even on rewatch, it still sits with me. It's very strange. Even if I've seen these episodes countless times, I know the beats, it still unsettles me, which is a very rare thing. And I think it's to the show's credit. But as you pointed out, it's to the show's credit, it doesn't make it any easier to watch.
Yeah, I mean, like, to sort of make an analogy to something that is as dark and caustic as Millennium could be, I would have to point to, like, you know, like maybe Japanese horror movies or something. There's just something there that is very, it's like worst fears realized in a way. And, you know, it's not a show that you can binge. When I watch Millennium, when I rewatch it, and I have rewatched it up until recently, I do it an episode at a time. And because that's usually all I can take, I can't take more than one episode at a time. You know, particularly of the first season. Each season sort of comes across as a film in and of itself, and has that same kind of rhythm and that same kind of auto-completion, if that's a term that I can coin, that, you know, it's almost like you need time to rest. You know, when you go see a movie that really affects you, you don't feel like going out and seeing another movie right away. You've got to sort of let that digest and settle, and you've got to process it. And that's kind of the way I feel about Millennium.
Here's an interesting one. What is your favorite episode then? What is the one that you sit with, or the one that you most, the one that sat with you most?
This is going to be like a totally off the wall one for most people, but Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense is my favorite Millennium episode, but it's also my favorite Darren Morgan episode by a very wide stretch.
Wow.
Yeah, I love that episode. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
No, I love it too. It's just, by your favorite Darren Morgan episode by a wide stretch is kind of an interesting
one.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's head and shoulders above anything else he's ever written. Yeah, I was very disappointed in Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. I thought that was sort of like a half-written episode that could have been a lot shorter. Or I don't know. I would have even taken some of the ideas, like, you know, say like the serial killer and idea, and expanded on that. But there's just something very half-baked about it. and half-hearted, I think. But Doomsday Defense to me is, I think it's one of the best things that 1013 ever produced. I think it's one of the best, black comedies that I've ever seen in any medium. I just think it's an absolute work of genius and by far my favorite episode. I mean, it's probably the most atypical episode. I mean, maybe you'd want to ask me what my favorite more typical episode is. I don't know, but that is definitely my favorite episode.
And it's funny you should mention that, actually, describing it as atypical, because it is an episode that you can almost go out and sample of yourself. I mean, I remember having conversations with people about Millennium and this sort of thing. And like Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense was a weird recommendation, but it was a safe recommendation because it's like, this is... It's not as caustic and, as you point out, caustic and confrontational as the rest of Millennium. It's something that's kind of broader and more accessible in a sense, in that you can watch it without having watched any of the rest of the show. And I think it sits relatively well.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, is that it's fun.
Yeah.
And Millennium was never fun. X-Files was fun. I mean, even when X-Files could get really dark, there was always a sense of fun about it. There was always a sense of play about it. Millennium was never that show. Millennium was almost like a tantrum. And I don't want to sound very negative, but it's just like, you know, it's problematic to me. It's a show that I love in a way that, you know, you would love a problematic child, I guess. It's a difficult show. I mean, there's a reason I think that the ratings really cratered halfway through. I don't think it was any comment on the quality of the writing or the production. I think the quality and the writing and the production were brilliant, but it's just a hard show to watch and it's a hard show to love. You know?
Yeah. It almost feels like something that would probably play better in the modern prestige landscape. You could stick it on HBO for, 8 episodes a year and that would be enough for people. And it could be, and while it wouldn't be for everybody, it would be sustainable under that model. It really feels kind of something like that, to a certain extent.
Well, did you watch Mindhunter on Netflix?
We are going to talk about Mindhunter later on, I suspect, possibly as a frame of reference for this, I think.
Yeah, I loved Mindhunter. Yeah. That's like what, to me, Millennium could have been, but I don't think there hadn't been enough
television water.
Yeah, there wasn't enough water under the bridge yet. And I don't think you could really format a show in the way that you can do with binge watching prestige television.
All right. So the third question, and this is probably the one where we'll get the widest range of variance between sort of group members. What's your favorite season of Millennium?
That I can't say. No, I really can't say because to me, like, each season is so radically different from the other. Each season has its own strengths and weaknesses. You know, that's another very peculiar thing about the show is that none of the episodes, none of the seasons really hang together as a whole. They're very different. You know, you have sort of Chris Carter's vision and maybe Ken Horton's to a certain extent in the first season. And then you have Morgan and Wong in the second season, but you also have, Ken Horton again and Chip Johannesson. And then you have Chip Johannesson and Michael Duggan in the third season, which sort of gave way back to reverting to the mean almost with Horton and Johannesson sort of taking over midstream. Midstream. And I think Horton's participation, I think, is undervalued. I think he was much more of an important force on the show than is generally recognized. But there's just such a radical discontinuity between the three seasons that I can't make that kind of assessment, because it really is like an apples and oranges thing.
I know that we're going to have some very interesting discussions in maybe a few months or a couple of years, maybe even we get to talking about certain parts of the show, because I know that you have some very interesting observations about all of the seasons. We'll talk about this a bit later on, but you've covered Millennium on the Secret Sun blog, and your insight into each of the seasons is amazing, and I hardly recommend people check that out. All right, fourth question, which is, who is your favorite character?
Well, this is going to be another sort of left field entry. My favorite character is Emma Hollis.
Oh.
I love Clea Scott, but I also thought she was just like a perfectly realized character from the jump. I'm not exactly sure that I could say that about all the other characters outside of Frank. I think that, that Chris Carter and Lance spend a lot of time working out the character of Frank Black. I don't think that as much attention was given to the secondary characters, but I love Emma Hollis. I love Clea Scott. She was in a program that I really recommend anybody who's a fan of 1013 watch, a show called Intelligence, which was created by a guy named Chris Haddock, who worked, had a show called Da Vinci's Inquest, which basically is everybody who is a character
guest star,
actor. Yeah, on the X-Files is a star of the show. I mean, it's so funny to watch because it's like, you know, Vancouver's the guest star and, it's just like basically like it's the X-Files without aliens and Mulder and Scully. I'm a big fan of procedural, police procedural kind of material. But I loved Emma Hollis. I love her complexity. I think that her complexity is very undervalued. I loved her arc, but I also loved that, one of the other major problems that I would have with the first season of Millennium is that it lacked sort of like a feminine perspective. It was very male. It was almost like a heavy metal kind of show. It was like you didn't have that sort of light and shadow interplay. And, Catherine, I think, was a little too, I mean, she was too subjective. She wasn't experienced in the cases firsthand. She wasn't really a player. I mean, outside of a couple episodes.
Yeah.
And Lara Means was just insane. She's just like, she's seeing angels everywhere. She's just nuts. I loved Emma Hollis. I thought she was a brilliant character. I loved her complexity. I loved her moral complexity. I thought it was written and played perfectly throughout the season. And whatever issues that I might have or other people might have with the third season, I think that, she's not one of them. I think she was brilliant. I think her character was brilliant. And the performance is brilliant. It's kind of this in the same fashion that, whatever problems people might have with season 9, you can never fault John Doggett or Robert Patrick.
Yeah.
None of it was ever his fault because he was always good.
All right. And then finally, fifth question, what is your favorite moment from the series?
this is going to be like another weird one because this is just like my weird sort of sense of humor, I guess. But the scene in Powers, Principalities, Thrones,
and Dominions,
the trial scene, and it's like, you've been accused. Sorry. And just like in the way he confesses to the murder and stuff. I love that scene because it's so dry and so absurd.
So wonderfully weird. It's one of the moments where Millennium really embraces the kind of weirdness, I think, that sort of been simmering in the background of the show. Not in the background of the show, but it's the kind of when it comes out in full broad daylight in a situation where it really shouldn't. I love that moment as well.
Yeah, I mean, I love that episode overall, but I just think that moment is great. And I love the reaction shots with, like, Terry O'Quinn just sort of like laughing at it. It was just brilliant. And, the acting was brilliant. The casting was brilliant. It was just, that is my favorite moment. And it's such a strange sort of offbeat, atypical moment in the series, but I just thought it was phenomenal. And I wish there were more like that. You know what I mean? I wish there was more of that. There's so many excellent episodes, just recently I was that sort of run when you have like Covenant and Sacrament and, this and that, all these pretentious biblical titles, but the episodes themselves are so great. But again, you have to watch it and then say, all right, I'm not watching any more Millennium for a couple days or whatever, because I need to process this. But I think it could have used more of that. It could have used a little bit more leavening, or levity. So to speak. Levity to leaven it, that kind of deal.
All right. Let's move on to talking then a little bit about The Thin White Line. Before we jump in to talk about the episode itself, we generally ask for, we do some scores first. So out of curiosity, have you peaked at IMDb for this?
Let me look. I'm looking.
Don't look right now. No. I was just going to ask.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I was going to ask, do you have any idea what do you think the IMDb score is for The Thin White Line?
My guess it would be in the low 8s.
Bingo, you got it in one. Yep, 8.1.
Okay.
Which is the highest ranked episode since the pilot. The pilot scored 8.2, and then they've been sort of like banging around the 7s. It is, I think, the third highest ranked episode, the fourth highest ranked episode, or fifth highest ranked, sorry. It's the third tier, but the fifth highest ranked episode of the season. There's a couple banging around 8.2, and the highest ranked episode we are probably going to be talking about later in the season, so I won't spoil too much on it. But about yourself, if you had to rank The Thin White Line out of 10, Chris, what would it be?
Well, I very much like this episode, but interestingly enough, I think of the James Wong episodes, because Glenn Morgan was more working on the X-Files at the time. This is actually my least.
That they did for the season. So the 522666, is it? And the other one is Dead Letters, right?
Yeah, when it's interesting too, because Dead Letters, I think, is by far the best. I love that episode. As much as you can love a Millennium episode, I think it's a brilliant piece of writing, and I think it really shows sort of the flip side of the effect that putting yourself in the, you know, in the minds of a killer is going to have on you. So Dead Letters is my favorite. 522666 is my second favorite, and this is my third favorite. But it's like, it's not like my third favorite, it's like it's my least favorite. It's like my third favorite. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, because I love these episodes, again, as much as you can love a Millennium episode, very much. So, but interestingly enough, my grading with Millennium is a lot more stringent than it is on the X-Files. Yeah, so I would give this a 7.75.
That's a very precise metric.
Yes. So that's a BB plus. Okay.
Okay. You know, I'm going to ask you about the 0.25, but we'll talk about it broadly first.
Yeah. So that's it's a BB plus. Like if I was grading it in a classroom, it would be a BB plus. But I think it's a very powerful and well written episode of television. But there are some issues that I have with it that may not affect people who aren't as immersed in 1013 isms as I am.
Okay.
But, you know, but anyway, but no, I like this episode very much. And but the problem is that I'm just a little stricter with Millennium than I am with X-Files.
Interesting. We'll probably talk a bit about those 1013-isms in a moment. Personally, I'd probably give this an 8 because I sort of round. I tend to work on 0.5s and whole numbers. But yeah, I give this would be an 8 for me. Interestingly enough, it would probably be my favorite of the three Morgan and Wong episodes. And it's the same thing that you had there where it's like, you know, you talk about them as if being the third best Morgan and Wong episode of the first season is a bad thing. It's not. It's comfortably in like the top 5, 6, 7 of the season that third episode is. But, I absolutely love this. I like this a bit more. It's kind of weird, because maybe we'll segue into talking about the episode, because you mentioned that this is, as you point out, that Morgan and Wong, when they're working on the fourth season of The X-Files and the first season of Millennium, they kind of split their workload. So Glenn Morgan took care of most of the X-Files stuff, and Wong focused on the Millennium stuff. And what's interesting is that you have, broadly speaking, when you split the two, when they're together, they're great. And when you split the two out, you kind of get to see a little bit of contrast between them. And that's particularly true in, say, the X-Files revival seasons, where Morgan and Wong work on different episodes. And they're very, very different in terms of what they're doing. And so you have kind of a more clearer point of comparison. But yeah, so like if you look at, say, the fourth season episodes of the X-Files that they worked on, those tend to be more experimental, more sort of wild, more off-format, more sort of like bizarre, gonzo. And it's no coincidence that they're among the most divisive episodes the X-Files ever produced, with the exception of Home. Because they are weird, and they're strange, and they're surreal. And they're very similar to, like, Home Again in the 10th season, where, you know, there's this weird sense of, I don't want to say that it's unstructured, because, you know, Morgan has written enough television that he knows structure, and he knows how to structure stuff. But compared to, like, the format of a regular X-Files episode, they're a little bit, it's all over the place. It's several different concepts mashed together in a way that, you know, if you were being cynical about Home Again, you'd say that maybe not all the elements work well together. But if you really like it, you'd be like, well, this tastes unique and different and distinct from everything else around it. Whereas Wong's work on, say, Founder's Mutation, and I think you pointed this out, and it's a very astute observation. Founder's Mutation looks a lot like a Fringe episode. It's structured very much like a Fringe episode. It's got a formula like a Fringe episode. It's got a clearer sense of structure. And I think if you were being generous, as I was inclined to be towards it, you'd be like, Wong is doing, well, how do I write a typical boilerplate structure by structure episode of The X-Files in 2016? And it would look a lot like Fringe. And that's, you know, I would say, you know, if I was being generous, say that's why Founder's Mutation looks the way that it does. And so the Morgan and Wong episodes on the first season of Millennium, for me, are kind of odd because they seem to be the only ones that really get a sense of, like, structure of Millennium. Like, they feel like they're the scripts, apart from Carter's own, obviously, they're the writers who have a clear sense of, like, this is maybe how you write an episode of Millennium, which nobody but Carter has really done to this point, but we kind of got a grasp on it. They're the ones that really sort of, like, grapple with, you're doing a show about serial killers, and you're doing a show about hunting and catching serial killers. How do you build off those? And, like, I think that, like, Dead Letters, you're right, Dead Letters is one of the episodes in the season that really captures the sense of what it would actually be like to be a profiler who lives inside the heads of these people. Kaboom, or kind of 522666, is notable for being, like, an all-format episode that's about a bomber rather than a killer, but it's also very procedural and structural in a sense, and it's very, like, detailed in the way that Morgan and Wong scripts tend to be. And this one is as well, because this feels like... And it's weird that it comes halfway through the season, but it feels like one of the first scripts that you would write if you were writing a serial killer procedural show. It's the one that sort of like, it has the loose structural elements of something like Silence of the Lambs, where you've got a scene between, the detective or the guy who caught the killer conversing with the killer in prison, and you've got a copycat out on the loose, and you've got this race against time to stop a copycat. And it really, really works for me. And I think it sort of, it feels like an episode of Millennium that feels like it works so well within the structure of Millennium while also hitting all of its beats. And that's, I think, why I'm as fond of it as I am. But what about yourself? So what are your sort of rough thoughts about this?
There's a lot of complexity for me here. You had mentioned, and I think that anybody who would pay attention to the X-Files would notice pretty much straight off that it is, the structure of it is very similar in a lot of ways to Beyond the Sea.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I just watched, and, you know, if we want, we can touch upon how when Millennium went off the air, that a lot of Millennium's sort of mojo is imported into the X-Files.
Yeah.
But, you know, particularly I was watching Demonicus on the 9th season. It's a very similar format again. And, you know, of course, the obvious precedent here is following the Silence of the Lambs model.
Yeah.
You know, where a profiler or an agent speaks with an inmate who's brilliant and insane, and you know, but the interesting thing that I love about this episode, The Thin White Line, is that Hans is not Hannibal Lecter.
No. I mean,
Hans is an idiot and he's a scumbag and he's just a loser. I mean, he's just a male failure. And I think that one of the problems that I do have, and it sort of runs counter to your argument in a way, there was the whole serial killer of the week tag that Millennium seemed to pick up in the first season. And I actually think that's very valid, because if you look at the episodes that Carter wrote a serial killer episode. He wrote an episode about a cult. He wrote an episode about incest and child abuse. And then, you know, he wrote, he sort of almost demolished the serial killer mythos by...
With Lamentation.
With Lamentation, by having a serial killer, which is really just like a failed marginal man, in most cases a man, come up against a more profound and elemental evil.
Yeah.
So I think he was trying to show, like, well, this is what we can do. You know, we don't have to just do serial killers. But I think, you know, with the pressures of producing an hour of television a week for half a year, I mean, are enormous, especially with the, you know, production values and quality level that the 10-13 was struggling to maintain. I think that the serial killer motif, I think, really outwore its welcome. Like, Wide Open is a horrible episode. And it's stupid. I don't know if you like I hope I didn't insult anybody who likes that episode. Basically, it's just a bad riff on Blood Relatives, which is a great episode, you know, yeah. Which is a very interesting and well-written and complex and psychologically compelling story. And then they just like, well, that worked. Let's do it again. And then I think Weeds, there are some interesting elements in there, but it's just like, by that point, you just got sick of like seeing like...
Middle-aged, balding, white guys, you know, like, I think is how TV Guide described them.
Yeah, well, I think that's very apt, you know, sort of like nerdy, marginal men of low caliber. it's not compelling to me. It really isn't. I've never been a big serial killer fan. I've never really been fascinated by the whole idea of serial killers. I find it distasteful. Sexual violence is never something I find entertaining. It's something that I find repulsive. You know, even shit like bondage and any level of violence in sexuality, I find really disgusting. The thing that I really like what Wong does, and I don't know how intentional it was, but I think it's so subverts the whole serial killer mystique, is just to show like, this guy's just a loser. This just, he's nothing. He's nobody. You know, he kills out of a sense of resentment. You know, he resents that other people seem to have figured out how to get their act together, and he hasn't. You know what I'm saying? And then he infects another loser with that same mentality. And I think I'm not exactly sure how much Wong was trying to point in that direction and how deliberate this was. But the thing that I really like about that, you know, when Frank goes to talk to this guy, it's not like this mysterious, compelling, charismatic figure like Hannibal Lecter. It's just an idiot who wants Gary Busey to play him. It's just it's obnoxious. And then he's like stealing bits of bio from other serial killers, and Frank's just like
seeing right through it immediately. Like, it's amazing how quick he gets that single little backstory, and Frank is like not buying it, no sell. Which is, it's very much, as you point out, communicating that Frank is well beyond him, and he's as you point out, a bit of a failure, a bit of a loser. I mean, the same thing you could argue is true of Luther Lee Boggs in Beyond the Sea as well, where, you know, as much as he's a channel, as much as he, you know, it's possibly a channel for something else, he's portrayed very much as a pathetic figure.
Well, he is a pathetic figure, but he also has, you know, he has sort of a cadence to his rap, you know, this kind of a lilt there, you know. He isn't just like a dead-eyed, monotoned nobody like Hans is. I mean, Boggs, you know, he's memorable. He's a memorable figure. The only thing I remember about Hans is just those, you know, those very piercing black eyes he has. But otherwise, he's just a loser, and he's a failure, and he's trying to inflict his sense of loss and failure on other people. And that is how I personally see serial killers. This is why, again, like another problem that I have with Millennium, you know, particularly in this first season, is that I don't think these people should be in any way celebrated or glorified, because they're just nothing. They really are. I've read, you know, up on people like Dahmer and Gacy and a
Bundy
lot of these,
and Gain and so all the stereotypical sort of
I mean, you know, there's almost like a corpus now. There's like a serial killer canon, you know, and Zac Efron has that new film on Netflix about that.
It's Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Vile and Evil, which is a hell of a title.
Yeah, but like, it's just gross. I mean, I don't even think of these guys necessarily as evil. I just think of them as just like bitter and angry and just lashing out and amoral. And that's not, you know, those are not people that I find
compelling or interesting or engaging.
Yeah. And the thing that I really like about this episode is just how, you know, small and petty this man seems when he's inside the system. You know, that his only ambition in life is to have the
lights turned down. Yeah.
Fluorescent lights turned off. You know, that's basically the sum total of his ambitions in life. And I like that. You know, this is just somebody who should not be celebrated, who should not be a figure of fascination, who should just be
locked in a cage and forgotten.
Locked away and forgotten, you know? And that's the way I see it. And I think that with you know, his character, you know, the other character, he's even smaller. You know, he's even a smaller figure because he's modeling his life on somebody who's just an abject failure at everything. You know, I like that. And this is another thing. The way that Hans, you know, that he just sees himself as a hunter of men. But, you know, his double here, his protege, you know, Jacob Tyler, sort of needs to see himself as some sort of avenging angel figure, some sort of, you know.
Well, a celebrity at one point. He sees himself on the cover of Rolling Stone, to pick an example, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting that he has to develop this whole entire self-mythology. This, you know, he needs to auto-mythologize himself to justify what he's doing, because really what he's doing is just that, you know, he became so dependent on this other man that when he's released, when he's no longer in his orbit, he needs to reconstruct that in his mind. But he's not going to reconstruct the depressing and sordid aspect of Hans, the way Hans really is, just like just a nothing, just like a little void in the fabric of life and time. You know, he needs to, you know, like, sacrifices need to be made, and like all this kind of more stereotypical millenniumistic kind of mythology that he needs to see in himself, because he can't face the fact that he's he's even less than nothing.
I mean, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because and the question of like how much Wong was, well, consciously doing it, but also like foregrounding it, because there is this interesting kind of push and pull between the sort of like the extremes, where kind of it alludes to this weird thing that exists, and you sort of suggested as well this fixation that popular culture has on serial killers. And it's worth noting that like Millennium arrived at sort of like the peak of that sort of thing after the success of like Silence of the Lambs. Obviously, you had this huge explosion in pop culture.
Seven.
Yeah, and Seven as well. But even things like you had Single White Female, Copycat. You had stuff like Profiler came out around the same time as well. You had this huge like 90s sort of fascination with these
Basic
things.
Basic Instinct.
But yeah. And as you pointed out, the tendency to portray these sort of creatures, of these sort of people, as sort of like, you know, almost supernatural, sort of abstract, sort of like geniuses. I mean, the point of comparison where like when you come up on Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, and it's a still shot of him staring at you, knowing where you're going to be, like staring at you through the camera, versus the introductory shot of Hans, where he's like trying to bump his shoulder up against a cage to, as you said, turn off a fluorescent light.
And that's what you see in his underwear, too, which I think is like, it's so humiliating in a sense, you know. He's almost like he's on display.
Yeah.
He's like a caged animal, just like this tubby little nobody in his underwear,
yeah.
You know.
Almost like hurling dirt at the sort of tourists, you can imagine, to a certain extent. But I mean, there is this thing, and it's not really developed. And I think you're entirely right to say that. But it is there. And when you mentioned that kind of aspect of the serial killer and the glorification of the serial killer in popular culture, it kind of occurred to me a little bit. There is a little bit of that aspect of the weird serial killer as celebrity thing that runs through. I mean, you know, you have natural born killers early in the 90s. But here you have the cover of Rolling Stone, as I pointed out, where, you know, your man sees himself on there. Now, it says captured on it. But again, he's imagining himself on the cover of a magazine, which is very much... And a magazine associated with rock stars, celebrities, icons, and people who are important. But you even have things like when Hans is introduced, the first thing that he talks about is the idea of, as you point out, who's going to play him in this movie? And he wants Gary Busey to play him, which is very lowball, if we're being entirely honest.
Yeah. He's not terribly ambitious, is he?
No, I love that. I love the fact that like I don't have Cinemax. But there is this sense of like Hans imagining himself. You said auto-mythologizing for his sidekick who can't even imagine his own identity without borrowing Hans's. But with Hans, you know, even then there's a sense of, well, I'm going to be famous. This is going to be my ticket to fame and celebrity. And there is something interesting in that. And I think that the Thin White Line does handles that aspect of kind of like serial killer-ness, as it were, a bit better than some of the earlier episodes. I mean, you mentioned that Carter didn't actually write that many serial killer episodes. And I think the part of the issue with Millennium is that issue that you have when you're doing the first season of anything, where the object is fully formed in the mind of the guy who created it. So Carter obviously had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do at Millennium. But you're assembling a bunch of writers who are, you know, primarily working off the pilot script. And they have to come up with a way to do that, as you pointed out, 26 times a year, roughly once a week for half the year. And so as a result, you end up with a situation where you make a bad photocopy of the pilot for like your first 12 episodes. And that kind of becomes your mark. And it's kind of, I think that there is something interesting in this, in the way that it kind of does that with a serial killer. And it's interesting that around this point in the first season, the show starts moving away a little bit. You start getting more experimental stuff. You pointed to stuff like Lamentation, but even beyond that, you end up with stuff like Walkabout, which is very much not a serial killer episode in any way, shape, or form. And even later on, you have Maranthana, which is Johansson again doing interesting stuff that again is not strictly serial killer related. And it's kind of interesting that this comes at this point, halfway through the season, almost on the folding point.
That's something I want to bring up, because the sequencing here in the season and that aspect that you refer to, that, you know, not only is Carter sort of establishing this mythos that people are sort of coming along and copying, but he's also doing so under tremendous constraints on his time and attention. And I think that if he had more time, you know, that maybe he wrote the first four or five episodes.
Yeah.
But basically, the episodes that he did produce, if they sort of front-loaded those in the season, and he could just say, listen, okay, we're going to do a serial kill here, we're going to do a cult here, we're going to do, you know, this really dark incest story here, and then we're going to do this sort of this demonic thing to set up, you know, a kind of mythology, a kind of myth arc, you know, that this is about demons, and this is about the apocalypse, and but we want to keep the sort of ambivalence, you know, who are these people? Are they really demonic? Are they just, you know, insane? That kind of deal. I mean, if they front loaded those episodes in the season, I think that it would have given the writers a broader spectrum to draw on
yeah.
for their own ideas. But like, so we talked about Weeds And, you know, Weeds is fine for what it is, but it's just like in the placement when you've seen so many similar stories and kind of it is exhausting. And then like Loin Like a Hunting Flame, which is just like, oh, you know, do we have to see this again? You know, I mean, it's just yeah. There are some interesting ideas and there's some interesting visuals and there's sort of some interesting subtext that they're trying to play in there. But it's just so rote and it's so routine and monotonous. So then we get to Force Majeure, which is just like, what am I even watching here? This is insane. I mean, just like the teaser is like, are you kidding me? And then, so then Thin White Line comes next, and it almost seems like, you know, again, that reversion to the mean. But then Sacrament, which I just think is a phenomenal episode, because it sort of takes that, you know, we have another bald, pasty white guy show up. He's presented in a much different context. And again, he's minimized.
That's it. It's not about him. The story's not about him. It's about Frank Black and his brother.
But it's also about, like, that he's not even actually the killer. Yeah. He's just, like, he just kidnaps women for his father to torture. Yeah. And then Covenant, which, again, I think is a phenomenal episode, which is deep and dark sort of meditation on the death penalty and
like masculinity as well.
And, yeah, and masculinity and the inadequacies of the justice system. Sort of like an Old Testament religiosity sort of informs a lot of this. But then there's Walkabout, which, you know, goes in another direction. And then there's Lamentation and Powers and Principalities, which are really like, basically it's one long episode. I mean, it's following the same streams. So you have Thin White Line sort of placed in this very interesting and fascinating and really extraordinary string of episodes of television that are really doing things that I had never seen before, even in the movies to a certain extent. I mean, it's almost like Carter and the writers are almost drawing more novelistic precedents rather than television, and certainly rather than most movies, you know, because they're sort of dealing with a level of moral complexity that I don't think popular entertainment in America is generally well known for. You know, and again, before this, you know, Weeds and A Loin Like a Hunting Flame, you know, the sort of tiresome trope through the old garden of serial killers. You know, The Wild and the Innocent, I think, is another phenomenal episode.
Yeah.
You know, I was so shocked by where they were going and what they were after. You know, like, it was just really heartbreaking. And I thought that it was just very brilliantly written, very brilliantly played. Yeah, with The Thin White Line, again, I mean, I think it's an excellent, well-written and very canny and very perceptive hour of television. But a lot of my misgivings about it that make it only my third favorite have to do, again, with, like, do we really need to go back into the garden of serial killers again, and sort of like the quasi, what I call Carter in his William Blake mode, when he just ends up sort of sounding like a pretentious gothy teenager, you know, and you know, like the whole pseudo biblical window dressing and things like that. It wasn't a welcome return for me in that regard, but I did welcome the fact that it seemed that Wong was trying to subvert it.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I think that it does arrive a bit late. And being honest, had this arrived third or fourth in the season, I think it would be very, very welcome and much more welcome and would fit a lot better if it had been like the third or fourth episode the show produced. But I think that there is something interesting there in the way that it... And again, I don't want to oversell it, and I don't want to... Because there is a lot of wonderful weirdness. The second half of the first season of Millennium is absolutely amazing, and Force Majeure and The Thin White Line sort of sit on the cusp of that. And it almost feels odd. It almost feels like they should be in the other direction. You know, they should be starting with this and then going into Force Majeure and then just running straight with the craziness.
I don't want to break up your train of thought, but it's really important to say that this is, I think, is the failure of Carter as a showrunner in this season of X-Files. I mean, X-Files of Millennium, is that at his, you know, when he had so many hours of television under his belt by this point, this season should have been plotted out more carefully. But I think there should have been a greater sense of attention to detail, and the sequencing that you just referred to, I think, is a very important part of that. Yeah. I'm sorry, but
no,
go ahead.
No. And it's entirely fair. And it is worth noting again, like, we live in an era where, like, prestige model, you can't count on showrunners to get out 10 hours of television a year. But when Carter was operating, he was doing this, The X-Files, and the feature film. So he was producing, what, you know, 48 episodes a year and a feature-length film on top of it, which is absolutely absurd. Like, that's enough to drive somebody crazy, completely over the wall. And I mean, I would agree entirely that, like, I think both seasons and the feature film do suffer from that. But I also, like, I am in awe of the fact that it didn't collapse into a flaming wreck.
For the amount of work that he's doing, it's phenomenal. It's just... It's almost like an achievement that I can't think of any precedent for.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to diminish that, but what I'm trying to say is that it would have been so much better, you know, had
it been a single-minded focus, had it been, as you point out, front-loading this. If, like, the two-parter that comes two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the season had instead arrived one-quarter of the way in the season and set the tone for what was coming, it would have flowed a lot better. And I think you're entirely right there. I would agree with that, absolutely.
But, you know, the thing that should be pointed out as well, though, is that his attention was very much on Millennium, and Howard Gordon had sort of filled his spot in the fourth season, at least the first half of the fourth season of Millennium.
Of X-Files.
Now, and the interesting thing is, you know, Vince Gilligan said something. What Carter had done, and I think that was a very wise and perceptive move that I think a lot of other showrunners would be hesitant to do because they would be hesitant about their power being challenged down the line. But he almost required his writers to also become producers.
Yeah.
That he, you know, that he wanted his writers on set, that he wanted his writers to cast, to sit in the editing room. And you know, what Gilligan had said is that, you know, when it got to this huge crunch in this year, you know, the 1996-1997 season of both X-Files and Millennium, that he, you know, he said the ship never steered itself, that Carter was always at the helm, but he had trained his seconds, his lieutenants, so to speak, to pick up a lot of the slack that maybe another showrunner would have to deal with themselves. So, and that's why I think so many people who worked in the X-Files went on to so many bigger and better things, because they were so well conditioned to accept a lot of these responsibilities. I mean, Carter was very much a control freak, make no mistake. Yeah. But he also, I mean, you know, one thing that Gilligan said is that, you know, Carter could always be argued out of an idea, that if somebody had a better idea, he would go with it. You know, that Carter was always willing to let people express themselves. Yeah, and make their case. But he was also willing, you know, it was almost like, you know, the mother bird kicking the little babies out of the nest so they can learn to fly on their own, you know, they can learn to feed themselves. That he really wanted his writers to be, you know, self-sufficient, to be self-sustaining. And I think that really speaks a lot. And I again, there are so many aspects of Carter as a showrunner, because it's so poorly understood by the general public what that even entails, what a producer, executive producer has to be responsible for, that so many people watching television have no idea what that even means. You know, I think even people who very heavily criticize him will be, you know, have to acknowledge that he would allow people to really experiment. And I think that the strength in this string of episodes that we're discussing, that Thin White Line sort of sits in the middle of, is that, you know, the writers are starting to, you know, define their own sea legs and to really pull at the limitations of the concept, I think.
Well, I mean, like, just to reinforce that point, I mean, the fact that we were able to talk about Morgan and Wong episodes as their own thing, having their own stylistic sensibilities and their own perspectives and fitting in their own context within, like, the X-Files and Millennium, sort of demonstrates how much Carter had sort of, like, encouraged writers to find their own voices. And you can do the same with Spotnitz, you can do the same with Gilligan, you can do the same with Gordon as well. And I mean, it's rare that you have that on a show where you have all these different voices and you can definitely point to one and say, that's a Gordon script, that's a Morgan script, that's a Wong script, and I can tell because they're distinct and they're different while still fitting as part of the whole. And I think that Carter doesn't get enough credit for, like, managing that and encouraging that and finding a way to turn that into a strength of the shows that he worked on. But just actually to get back to sort of what I was talking about a moment ago, which is how the Thin White Line sits in the sense where in the space where Millennium is getting gradually weirder, and how this is, you're right that this is a middle-aged, balding, white guy killer episode to a certain extent, but there's also an undercurrent, I think, of weirdness that it isn't as pronounced, obviously, as Force Majeure, because Force Majeure is off the reservation, so to speak. It's just completely gonzo. Like, I mean, it opens with this wonderful sort of abstract imagery, and somebody lighting themselves on fire in the middle of a hailstorm. There's no way you could really sort of like compete with that in like a Serial Killer of the Week format. But even then, there is this sort of like almost abstract aspect to the teaser for this episode, where you have the scar on Frank Black's hand and the scar on the victim's hand without any context. You have the weird subjective thing that happens, which is interesting of itself. And you point out this idea of auto-mythologizing for the killers, but it's something that's very strange and very weird, even within the confines of Millennium, because Millennium obviously has the idea of Frank Black's visions. And the show goes back and forth on whether his visions are supernatural or whether they're sort of like psychological. I'm actually kind of curious. I might ask you in a second what you make of Frank Black's visions. But like, this is a point where the show sort of, where Morgan and Wong take that concept and just amp it up to 11, where it's not just Frank Black's subjective, like, interpretation of the world that the film is processing. It's also the serial killers, where you get that version of a conversation play out, and then you see what actually played out later over it. So the camera is no longer an objective observer. It's actually putting you in this weird perspective or headspace. It's not pretending to be, like, objective or sort of separate from that. And I find that kind of fascinating, and it is a little weird. Even after the teasers, the first sequence is a flashback / dream sequence, which again, you know, is a little bit stranger compared to some of the stuff that we see on the show at this point. And while yes, it is formulaic and it is structured, it is a little odd for me in that sense. But actually, just to bring back to the question I suggested there a moment ago, do you have any thoughts on, like, Frank Black's visions? Because I know this is something that's, like, even today it's hotly contested between the writers on the show, let alone the fans. But what do you make of Frank Black's visions?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it speaks to this episode, but it also speaks to the other episodes that, you know, particularly James Wong wrote. Dead Letters, I think, very brilliantly sort of shows where that kind of, you know, that Frank's gift, quote unquote, can put you. It can put you in a world of just complete hallucination and delusion, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is explored again here. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, those, the episodes that sort of bookend his time on the first season, you know, Wong's time on the first season, that he's exploring Frank's gift, you know, sort of from two opposite extremes.
The other profiler and then the literal other side of the white line.
Yeah, and I love the visions that Tyler has in this, because I think they make him a much more interesting character than I think even Hans himself. I think, you know, Hans, again, is just a grubby little punk who thought that killing would be his ticket to immortality. And even his whole rap about, you know, eat your fear, it all sounds so canned and fake. And insincere. And I think that's deliberate on Wong's part. The Tyler is the much more interesting character here, because, you know, I've talked a lot about how, like, mind control sort of plays a lot in Chris Carter's thinking. And there's a lot of it, you know, you guys recently talked about Gehenna. And, you know, Gehenna has the whole thing with the LSD and the mind control, and, you know, the cults and all that kind of cult mind control and so on and so forth. But it's almost like Tyler, he's an interesting character that you could potentially read a lot into, because it's like he's based his whole life on becoming this grubby loser who has nothing interesting to say at all, really. I mean, everything he says is sort of like a rewrite of somebody else's story. Tyler is out there. I mean, he's obviously a completely delusional schizophrenic who has these weird visions, but it's almost like he's almost compensating. It's like he sort of sees himself. It's like, you know, Hans is nothing. I'm less than nothing because I'm under his thumb, I'm under his control. But is he under Hans's control, or is he under his own idea of what Hans's control is? Because Hans is not nearly as interesting and has, you know, doesn't have that kind of biblical avenging angel mentality that Tyler has. So Tyler's a much more interesting character. I think he's a much more compelling character. I think this is a very good episode of television, but I would have liked to have seen a lot more of him and a lot more of his point of view than Hans, who's just a grub, you know?
Actually, it's kind of interesting in terms of, like, bringing that up. And in terms of Hans's sort of, like, the idea of Hans as, like, a tinned serial killer to a certain extent. Like, even things like the death cards that he uses, for example, are obviously taken from Vietnam and stuff like that. And are also, I think, a Morgan and Wong sort of shout out to their own work on Space Above and Beyond. Is it the 58th Airborne Division as well, the wild cards? I think that's sort of an allusion to that as well. But yeah, there's something very sort of interesting in that. And the idea that, like, when Hans is captured, he asks Frank, can you see what I see, FBI, as well? Which is very much getting into that sort of subjective headspace as well, which is kind of weird. And it is, like, this is the thing with Millennium, where you did have these sort of Serial Killer of the Week episodes, which, you know, is a little bit dismissive, but, you know, is accurate to a certain extent for certain stretches of the first season. And I like that there is this sort of weirdness there, if that makes sense. And there is a kind of a sense of structuring and duology as well. You know, if you have the ripped cards, the fact the killer, you know, kills in two pairs of two. And you have this idea of Hans and Jacob having shared lives as well, where he's like, I lived as Jacob, he lived as me, we were as one. And you have this sort of like, and again, it doesn't delve too much into this, and it would be very easy to do this heavy-handedly, but you have this idea of, like, Frank Black having this vision of himself shooting Hans, which is kind of one of the interesting aspects of the episode. The dream that he has where he sees himself capturing Hans as it actually happened, but then he has his own nightmare later on where he has Hans at cold, dead to rights, and has the gun pointed at him and almost pulls the trigger. And this is interesting in a number of ways. First of all, it obviously foreshadows where Morgan and Wong would go with the second season. It's not intentional because they didn't know they were going to be coming back and running the second season, but it kind of sets up this idea of who Frank Black is and what he does and how he deals with this evil in the world. It's interesting as well because it kind of brushes, it touches on something that I think was important to Carter and to Lance Henriksen in characterizing Frank Black. When Black went back to Frank Black, like, did a press release, I think in what, 2016? Announcing or, like, trying to raise awareness for the show, one of the quotes they had from Henriksen was that, you know, Frank Black is a man who solves problems with his mind and not a gun. So it's kind of interesting to see the emphasis that this places on Frank Black not using a gun or not using a firearm or sort of, like, choosing not to shoot Hans. And there's an interesting sort of thread running through this about the death penalty even as well, or about systemic abuse, or maybe I'm reading too much into this.
Well, no, I mean, well, you know, that's what the show is all about, right? you know, it's like, I think reading into it, you know, one is that Carter was always inserting so much beneath the surface. You can't help but read that. I mean, I'll give you an example. Improbable in the ninth season, episode about numerology. Apparently he had used pop songs that came out of Naples, because Naples is a huge numerological sort of mecca, you know, that Naples has famously throughout history been, you know, great enthusiasts of numerology. So to use Neapolitan pop songs in an episode about numerology, I mean, you know, that's how that Carter thinks. I mean, Carter, I've always said he's a very fractal thinker. And I think that fractal thinking informs other writers and informs other series. I think that Carter was always encouraging his writers to dig really deep, you know, even if it's not explicitly spelled out, but the more you can layer in, you know, all these kind of, yeah, the richer it becomes. And that's why it's so interesting still to talk about these shows. And that's why it's still interesting to watch these shows, because I can't tell you how many times I've watched, like, episodes of The X-Files. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute, that's that. Oh, Jesus, I didn't think about that. I mean, oh, man, I mean, how did I never notice that? He's exploring in very interesting ways here. But, you know, it's just picking up these things. You know, Glenn Morgan talked about, you know, that sort of explicit heaviness of Millennium really influenced the fourth season of
The X-Files.
X-Files. And, you know, there were even plans. I mean, they had wanted to bring back the Peacock family.
Oh, for the second season of Millennium, and we're told no.
Yeah, no. The Fox execs said those people will never be seen on my network ever again. If you really look at home, you could make that with very little revision, make that a Millennium episode, because there's nothing
supernatural
about it. It's just a, you know, a very, very weird science episode, but it's really, you know, those guys would fit very comfortably into the Millennium universe if you ask me. So I think it's very interesting just the way that sort of played in. And then you have, like, episodes like, you know, Sanguinarium, which is, you know, pretty dreadful, but you can sort of see the
little ideas are bubbling through.
Yeah, like the whole idea of, like, you know, demons in human form and things like that that you'll see later on. I mean, well, of course, we saw those in the X-Files before, but you'll see those later on.
Well, I mean, like, even things like the burning bodies in the pilot here come back in, like, you know, Patient X and the Red and the Black later on. You could argue that there are aspects of, say, the war in heaven as it occurs in Lamentation, Powers, Principalities, and Thrones of Dominion that Carter just recycles whole-scale thematically for Patient X and the Red and the Black in the fifth season of the X-Files. There's a lot of sort of cross-pollination happening there, even if it's not a literal sense.
Well, you know, it's very interesting you bring that up, because I don't know if I discussed this with you, I might have discussed it with Carl, but we were talking about All Souls from the fifth season, an episode that I like very much, by the way. I know a lot of people don't like it very much, but I like it very much. But to me, what All Souls does is that it takes the X-Files mythology and it just sort of dials back the clock to its sort of expressions in, you know, apocryphal Christian eschatology, yeah, and, you know, Catholic folk myth. These episodes that we're talking about, X-Files and Millennium, they don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in a cultural ecosphere, but they also exist in, you know, the midst of lore and myth and history and so on and current events. I mean, that's what makes it so fascinating, because these writers were putting all this stuff in, even if it's not necessarily, you know, part of the explicit text of the plot and so on and so forth. So I think that even a bad episode of The X-Files, or even a bad episode of Millennium, to me is very much worth watching, because it's not going to be like a bad episode of, I don't know,
NCI, Law and Order, yeah. Yeah.
CSI or Law and Order or something, where it's just like this dreary, paint-by-numbers, yeah, lifeless kind of rote recitation of well-worn out tropes. You know, even when these guys failed, they were shooting for the bleachers, you know? I mean, they tried, and I don't think you can ever accuse any episode the 1013 produced, you know, as being, you know, badly researched or poorly thought out. I mean, maybe poorly thought out in execution, but, you know, there was always this very, very heavy,
like a nugget of a good idea at the very least.
Well, yeah, but there was all, you know, it was all coming from this very rich and well populated sort of ecosphere where so many ideas and concepts. I think that I would have loved to have been in those writers' rooms, because I just would have loved to have seen, just like, I would have loved to have heard the ideas that they didn't produce, you know, and I'd love to hear like, yeah, the suggestions that were made that were never written into the, yeah, scripts. Because I just think that these guys and you know, a few women here and there were very, you know, just very plugged in and very motivated, you know, even later on in the run of this, you know, when in a time when everybody is just exhausted in any television. I mean, 9 hours of, I mean, 9 seasons of television, you know, everybody is just basically the walking, unless they've
200
had
200 episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless they've had full and complete turnover of the staff. I mean, you're just talking zombies.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you wanted to get into Frank's gift, and I'm sort of making this very roundabout, you know, circuitous journey back to that. I think that, again, it's this, one of these things where Carter is always going to, you know, sort of hedge his bets. I think that it's clearly a psychic gift, but I think that there was a resistance to referring to it as a psychic gift, because that would just sort of put it back in the X-Files
box sort of
universe.
Realm, yeah.
You know what I mean? That, I think there was a very deliberate attempt to differentiate the two TV shows as much as you can when you're using the same actors in the same settings.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and the same writers as well. And in some,
yeah,
ways,
I mean, yeah, there's so much of the same. And I think that if they came out and said, well, these flashes he get are psychic flashes, and that's why he's such a great detective profile. Yeah. That's also why he's so damaged and so fragile, because, you know, he's that sort of idea that Darren Morgan talked about, you know, and he talked about like the genesis for Clive Bruckman is that he was doing research for somebody on an episode, and he was looking through all these books of crime scene photos, and he was really upsetting, you know. He's like, and it's like it just occurred to him, like, if you were like one of these police psychics, like, this is what you would have in your head all the time. You know? It would be like a torment, it would be torture. It's like, you know, Clive Barkman says it's like a gift, or the problem, it's non-returnable. And I think that I think a lot of that plays into the character Frank Black. They just didn't want to go there because
it would be too obvious, or sort of it would invite too much of a strong comparison to a show that was already like in the shadow to a certain extent of the X-Files, perhaps.
Yeah, but I think it would have really done the show a lot of good that if it was presented as a spinoff, and that you had sort of a lot of the say secondary FBI personnel that you sort
like
of
Pendrell
see
or whatever, or even yeah, Skinner because, once or twice or something, yeah, that sort
exactly.
of thing.
Because I think a lot of people just thought this is just some weird thing that has nothing to do with, you know, my obsession, which is the X-Files, you know.
You talk about like the idea of this being like, again, the Morgan and Wong, but the serial killer, and the idea of like minimizing the serial killer as like something to be glorified and something that's sort of romanticized. Like Hans, again, as you pointed out, is introduced like something on display, like an animal bashing his shoulder against the top ceiling. One of the things I find interesting is, and again, maybe reading too much into this, but there's an interesting sort of suggestion of like systemic, you know, sort of like a systemic process here, where you have this idea of like Hans going off to Vietnam, learning how to kill, and then literally bringing the skills back with him here to the point of using the death cards, for example. But you have even things like, for example, the, you know, the use of the kind of the fact that like when he's in prison, the fact that when we institutionalize people like this, he's locked up and he's able to sort of like imprint his mind on his cellmate. You have a cellmate who was in for like, I think, robbery, but nothing violent, who comes out of prison a killer as a result of like the process and the way he's been trapped and institutionalized, and sort of that behavior as well. And you even have, again, this issue of Frank wondering whether or not he can save lives, whether you can save the life of somebody like this who is a serial killer. And you have this, like, again, this almost like bleak ending with Bob Bletcher, who like just can't take the risk and does take the shot that Frank didn't take back then. And there's a lot of interesting stuff sort of playing through that thematically. And like, again, this is big ideas. These are big ideas that I don't think you'd get on, as you pointed out, stuff like Law and Order, CSI, NCIS. And I like that aspect of it as well. And I think it does differentiate it from stuff like Loin Like a Hunting Flame or Weeds or Wide Open, which, as you pointed out, I'm sure everybody, you know, one of those is somebody's favorite episode. But for me, just got a little bit exhausting. And I think that sort of elevates it a little bit for me as well.
No, I agree with you. And I think that this is something you saw in The X-Files from pretty early on, because The X-Files is really a critique of systemic violence, really. And I think that the Carter had really explored the whole situation with the prison industrial complex after he had done the trilogy with Anasazi, Blessing Way, and Paperclip. So the next...
The List, doesn't it?
Story, yeah, The List is sort of the next, you know, that's the next step in his thinking is the prison industrial complex, and how there almost seems to be, you know, this machine that takes troubled young men and accelerates their violence, and, you know, either absorbs it into the military or absorbs it into the prison system. And there's an interesting thing I want to point out here, because when I, about 20, 25 years ago, maybe around the same time this episode might have been filmed, I had been invited to a private bar in Teaneck, New Jersey, that was like basically like an illegal speakeasy for Marine veterans. And you know, it was a very interesting, it's just like this basement with a bar, and I think mostly they just served beer, you know, and it was like a bunch of Marine veterans from different wars. And I was actually talking to a guy from World War II at the time, who was, you know, this is back in the 90s. So, you know, he's early 70s.
Show, yeah.
Well, I actually think he was like in his early 70s, but he was very spry and he was very fit. But the guy who invited us to this bar was a friend of my my sister-in-law's, and we were sort of just wandering around looking at all the memorabilia. There's a lot of memorabilia and photographs and stuff. And then there was this poster of Vietnam War lingo, you know, sort of the slang that the soldiers had used, and other terminology and so on and so forth. But you know, he said, you know, he's reading off and, you know, and then he gets to Operation Phoenix and he didn't know what it was. And like, it was the weirdest experience, Darren. Like, out of nowhere, this guy comes up who looks like Thor after like a few rough decades. I mean, he's tall, just very like sunburnt, very frightening, very intimidating man with like long hair and a very ruddy face and very scary eyes, starts ranting about Operation Phoenix and, you know, talking about, I was like, you know, assassins and death cards and all the stuff. And he starts just going, and we were frightened. Yeah. Like, I was afraid of this guy. This guy was not a guy that you would want to mess around with in any context. And, you know, he's talking about like, you know, assassinations and it came pretty clear to me that this guy was one of the products of Operation Phoenix. Wow. And Operation Phoenix was basically like an assassination program that the CIA had run and they had sort of hired, you know, Marines to carry out
things. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a really brutal, ugly thing. And it was secret. I think it was one of these things that sort of came out like in the post Watergate era in the 70s.
Yeah.
But it seemed pretty clear to me that this guy was like, you know, sort of like the byproduct of that. And, you know, so what happened is that the systemic violence, you know, the war machine would just take troubled young men, a lot of guys who were on their way to jail at the time, and throw them over in these cauldrons, you know, where they, you know, they're basically, you know, going to kill people so, you know, corporations can abscond their natural resources. And then, like, what do you do with them when they're done? I think a lot of them committed suicide. It's like, but what, you know, the Hants in this regard, I think, is a very, very apt example of this, because, you know, it's a troubled guy, a psychotic and a psychopath who's all of a sudden given like very highly developed skills to kill other human beings, but like they're pointing him in one direction and then like they don't need him anymore and he comes back, and how does he operate in society? And the answer is that he doesn't. He ends up in prison. And I think that this was a very you know, huge issue for people domestically, you know, in this country, to like, how do you deal with like these people who are essentially killing machines, who have, you know, very deadly and dangerous skills to harm other human beings. And, you know, once the military is done with them, they just kick them loose. And I think in that regard, I think that systemic violence that I think, you know, Chris Carter and his other writers are so concerned about and have such, I think, very highly developed critiques about, that I think are undervalued in that regard. You know, I think that's another thing that informs this episode. And I think, you know, just get back to, you know, those 1013-isms that I referred to, you know, like that, oh, you're not who you are, that little callback to ICE. It just made me wince. I was just like, no, don't say that. It was just that made me wince.
Or even, this is who we are. I always read that as a sort of a reflection of the show's motto rather than a winking nod to ICE.
I think it was exactly. And that's something that you know, every writer sort of has their tics that sort of drive you nuts after a while. And that's like one of, you know, the Morgan and Wong tics, is sort of calling back to, you know, like the fact that, I don't know if you ever noticed, but every X-Files script that Glenn Morgan wrote has, you know, Mulder referred to himself as Spooky in it. And, you know, which, you know, it's cute the first couple of times, but it gets annoying. But, yeah, and the how deep is your love scene? I mean, that's something that...
Well, that is another 1013-ism. That's Morgan and Wong using music, popular music, similar to Wonderful. It's a Morgan and Wong-ism.
No, it's not even a Morgan and Wong-ism. No? It comes from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The whole, you know, the scene when the little boy is being abducted by the aliens. There's like, I think it's like Pop Goes the Weasel, or, you know, some kiddie record. And that's like, that's how far back that riff goes. It's just like, it's not even like, it would be one thing if it was sort of like their own riff, but it isn't. Yeah. It's somebody else.
But that they've played repeatedly over the course of their time working in television.
Other 1013 writers sort of adopted that as well. And it just gets to be like, yeah, okay, we get it. You know, like the cute and innocuous song playing while something horrible is going on. whatever. I mean, it's just it gets to be a little overdone, I think.
They can't be wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. And because there's a setting there, there's a context there, you know, that sort of makes it work, that I don't think other examples of that riff, so to speak. You know, it's like the riffs, you know, it's like every guitarist is sort of their pet riffs that they'll include in every solo, and that's sort of theirs. That's sort of like, that sort of downgrades it. But again, I don't know if that downgraded it the first time I watched it before I had, you know,
all the context for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Several decades of rewatches under my belt, you know, so I don't think that anybody else noticed that, but it's just, you know.
I was going to say, just one more thing, actually, sort of before we get to the reader feedback and comments and stuff like that. Worth noting, actually, and I think you've pointed out that you wanted, and again, this ties us back neatly to what we were talking about at the start of the hour, where we're talking about the Mindhunter. And the sort of the idea that, like, Millennium today, or if it were conceived today, would probably look a lot more like Mindhunter on Netflix, which is the show produced by David Fincher, which is about the real life, it's heavily inspired by the real life FBI agents who, sort of did this criminal profiling. And you pointed out, actually, when we were discussing this, when we were talking about this offline, you sort of pointed out that there's a lot in this episode that's drawn very specifically from, the people or the FBI agents who directly inspired Millennium and also inspired Mindhunter as well. Robert Ressler in particular, I think you cited as a you think a key influence on this.
Well, I'll tell you who I think is a huge influence on this, and I think is a huge influence on the development of the Frank Black characters, a guy named Park Dietz. And Park Dietz sort of became well known for his work with Jeffrey Dahmer. Park Dietz is a forensic psychologist who was sort of called on as an expert witness in a lot of serial cases. He was, Dahmer, Unabomber, and then people like Andrea Yates, this woman who sort of drowned her children in this fit of religious rapture, which is very millennialistic. But he also did a series of interviews with the guy, Richard Kuklinski, who was also known as the Iceman, who was a mob hitman who has something like 100 plus killings under his belt, and had all these psychopathologies that sort of prevented him from feeling fear or remorse. And Park Dietz had done an interesting series of jailhouse interviews with him. But I think that he informed the character because I was watching something, I think it was from 92, and they're talking to Park Dietz, and he said, "To understand why someone is killing, I want to see it from their point of view." That's a direct quote from Park Dietz. So I think that you know, there is the obvious precedent with Red Dragon, you know, for Frank Black and for Millennium and arguably the X-Files as well, since so much of the X-Files draws on Silence of the Lambs. But I think this guy named Park Dietz, which is, it's almost like if you're going to like do a movie version of, you would call him Frank Black, right? You know, it's like same kind of those very abrupt sort of monosyllabic with hard consonant sounds. But I think that he was a huge influence on Black. And I think that Lance Henriksen probably watched videos of Park Dietz because there are certain facial expressions that he adopts while he's talking to Hans in this episode that really look like very, very Park Dietz-ish. You know what I'm saying? Like he's trying to sort of take on that persona, which is, you know, something that actors, you know, commonly do. And I think if you remember the regrettable episode 13 years later was sort of alluded to when the killer is somebody who's modeling himself after Frank Black. But we won't go there.
Well, for another couple another year or so anyway.
Because that is by far, I think, is the lowest point in the Millennium canon.
If you could kiss one Millennium episode goodbye, it would be that
one.
Wasn't a scream to watch, no.
No, that was a disaster. But anyway, no, I think that the character Frank Black is very heavily influenced by this guy because, you know, and he also started sort of, I know that the Academy Group is always cited as the
influence on the Millennium Group.
But this is something else I just wanted to touch on because I don't know if we'll really get another opportunity to do so in the other first season episodes we're going to discuss. But I think that, you know, again, we both agree that it's just this immense achievement on Carter's part to produce as much entertainment as he did in this 2 or 3 year period here. I think that, you know, I alluded to that I believe that so many of the other characters are kind of underbaked.
Yeah.
But I also think that the concept of the series itself was underbaked. I never really – I got to be perfectly frank with you,
that
I never really got what the link was between, you know, all the episodes and this sort of overarching idea of the millennium. I think that was like, I don't want to say it's a cheat, but I just don't think that it's something that Carter really thought out too well. I don't think it was very well considered. And I know that, that Lance Henriksen had major, major problems when Morgan and Wong started to just reimagine the Millennium Group as being the sort of Masonic cult, but they weren't very interesting in the first season. They just, you know, like people would just sort of show up and they'd walk in and out of camera and they never left any kind of impression on you. You never got any sense
of who these people were relative to one another, even. Like you could swap out the Millennium Group characters from the first season episodes and give Peter's lines to any other random guest star and it would serve the same purpose. Yeah.
Entirely interchangeable. And I mean, I think Peter Watts was well imagine. I think a lot of that is due to Terry O'Quinn just being a phenomenal actor. But, you know, it's interesting because I know that a lot of people quibble with this, but I like his arc throughout the series. I think that, you know, with the whole thing with the roosters and the owls in the second season and, you know, how these two opposing camps that, you know, either saw the millennium as imminent or, you know, not so much. And, you know, I think the way that Peter Watts is sort of drawn as a true believer, I think is very compelling. And I think that, you know, in the grand tradition of X-Files point of view storytelling, you know, we're sort of conditioned to see him as a villain in the third season. And I think that, you know, something that Henriksen said he was very confused by, but, you know, he's revealed with the last two episodes that he's not a villain, but he's just a true believer. And the true believer, you know, ties back to Anasazi. It's like, you know, you've never thrown in, then their doctrines become yours. And I think it's very fascinating that kind of thinking, whether or not it was expressly part of Carter's mission statement, but I think that the influence is there nonetheless. You know, and I'm always fascinated by unconscious influence and unconscious motivation, often more so than, you know, conscious or explicit motivation. And I think the fact that, you know, that we see any organization with a specific ideology, particularly an ideology doing with something like
Doomsday, the apocalypse. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to, you know,
buy-in is pretty total.
Yeah. The inclination, you know, because of human psychology and how organizations and ideologies need to sustain each other, you know, the ante needs to, you know, be constantly upped. And I think that is, you know, feels very true. And why I don't have the same kind of criticisms in that regard, because, okay, so like the Academy Group, I'm sure they're all fine guys. I'm sure they're all wonderful people and everything. But there are a lot of groups like that seem benevolent that maybe aren't so benevolent. You know what I'm saying? Like when you stray from the mission statement of doing good to the mission statement of sustaining the host, sustaining the organization, you know, that's when you start to make compromises. That's when you start to believe that the ends justify the means. You know what I'm saying? And we've seen this throughout history. So I think the arc of the Millennium Group going from like just this amorphous blob to, you know, a group of true believers who in fine eschatological tradition are willing to do horrible things in what they, you know, in the purpose of what they see as the greater good. I think that's very honest and I think it's very true. And I think the criticism that people have of that is that they're just not aware of the milieu that the writers were drawing from.
Yeah. And I think that, that maybe sets up some of the things that happen in the second season. Again, Morgan and Wong didn't think they're coming back. They thought they were going to make the Notorious. So it wasn't as if they planned these or seeded these to blossom earlier. But as you point out, it's more interesting to watch the unconscious themes. Like the idea that like this is something that interests Morgan and Wong as writers. This, and again, you, as Carter as well, as you pointed out, this idea of systemic violence, the idea of the individual within that. I think that the Millennium Group in the second season plays into that in a great way, where you have Frank, the second season, and again, we're going to talk about the second season in the second season. I don't want to get there, you know, too early. But like the large tension in the second season, the question of will Frank throw in? Will he buy in the way that Peter does? And you kind of almost have that here where you have Frank holding on to his own sense of individuality and individual morality in the face of a society that is, you know, that has all these systemic flaws, that wrote off these people as irredeemable from their own childhood. And Frank, you know, is trying to be better than that, or trying to get past that, or trying to present a version of heroism that is quite apart from that. And I find that sort of interesting. But I think that about wraps it up, unless there's anything more you want to talk about, unless we can just jump to the reader feedback.
Well, I did want to make notice that Jacob Tyler is played by Scott Heindel, who shows up. His actually his first acting role wow. is in Unruly, which is, you know, a very millenniumistic episode, I would argue. I think that Gilligan, I think, was very influenced by Millennium.
Writing Unruly and Paper Hearts back to back, two serial killer X-Files episodes. It almost feels like trolling to a certain extent, where it's like, yeah, sure, you know, Frank Spontanitz is going to go over and write a couple episodes for you. I'll write a couple episodes for you, but they're going to be X-Files episodes.
Yeah, and immeasurably superior episodes, I would argue.
Yes,
but Scott Heindel plays the boyfriend with the very, very, very thick Canadian accent in Unruly at the in the teaser.
In the little psycho subplot, yeah.
But this is also very interesting, too. He also plays, this was never really, maybe you can explain this to me, but, you know, when Lucy Butler is in her mannish alter ego, I'm not exactly sure what the implication is there, but he's the one who in Room with No View and Antipa, he plays Lucy Butler's alter ego.
Wow, I didn't twig that.
Which is referred to as the long-haired man, so.
Which makes a certain amount of sense. Wow, I never twigged that. I never realized that. I hadn't recognized him at all. I'd obviously recognize other people like Musther, for example, who plays the warden here, who's, you know, popped up in a variety of other roles, but I think Detective Manners in Jose Chung's Outer Space is one of my favorites.
I love that guy. I think that guy's phenomenal. I always enjoy watching him. I've seen him in a lot of other things too, and I just think he's a very entertaining and charismatic and personable actor.
But yeah, very quickly, so again, because I'm a real professional, I sent out a request about 5 minutes before we started recording.
Sorry, I noticed that. I'm sorry.
We keep things rolling. We're very professional here at the Time Is Now podcast. So a couple of things. A lot of good feedback. A lot of people loved it. Alexia Golez loved it. She's delighted that we're talking about it. Michael Black says it's one of the best episodes of the first season. Morgan and Wong nailed this show better than anybody else. The scene where Frank confronts his nemesis in prison is a serious high point for him. But he does say that, like, having said that, as much as The X-Files is more his cup of tea, he thinks Carter's work with Millennium is more consistent, but it maybe doesn't hit the same highs. He singles out Paperclip and Dwayne Barry as episodes that he thinks are maybe stronger in The X-Files than anything Carter wrote for Millennium. How do we think about that? What do we think about, like, Carter's, like, as a writer? Was his work on Millennium more consistent overall? Do you think it has higher highs or lower lows? Or
I actually very much like his first season episodes. And I noticed that a lot of people sort of downgrade Gehenna, but I think Gehenna is phenomenal, especially when you're sort of cognizant of the history, the very recent current events, really, that he's drawing on. Because that, I don't know if you're aware, but the cult in that is very much based on the Aum Shinrikyo cult in Japan. Yeah, who very, very recently, their leadership was executed in Japan, which I think is very unusual for capital punishment to take place in Japan. But I think it was last year.
What? I mean, they did the sarin nerve gas attack, though. Like, so, I mean, like, there was a huge scale there, I think, wasn't there?
But they were also trying to get their hands on, like, nukes and biologicals. And, yeah, they were very – that was a very scary story. And that wasn't that long before that episode aired. So I think that's sort of Carter – you know, Carter's he can be opaque at times. But I think that once you sort of crack his code, you realize that he's always drawing from things, you know, rather directly in his own fractal way. But the only episode that I don't know if I dislike it, but in the third season, 7 and 1, I just don't understand what that story is about. I've watched it several times and I just cannot wrap my head around it. I don't get what that story is about. I love Antipa. I think, you know, Antipa is my favorite Lucy Butler episode. And I think Teotihuacan, which is dated by now, but I think is a phenomenal.
That's an episode that I think of when I think about Carter being very current and very relevant as well, because that would have been very much like of its time. And when you're watching it, like watching it divorced from context, it's very like, it's like, well, this is a piece of commentary, but like at the time that that would have been released, that would have been so fresh and so raw. It's almost hard to imagine.
Well, I'll tell you something. I I knew that the Y2K thing was a hoax in 1998 when I received my new credit cards with the expiration date of 2000 on them. So I just, you know, call me crazy.
I was talking more about like the school shooting aspect of it as well. That's the
shooting. Oh, absolutely.
That really stuck out to me on rewatch because I remember that was like 1999.
I think that was pre-Columbine too,
yeah,
wasn't
that
it?
Was it was before Columbine. You had a couple of incidents like that, but it was still like it hadn't quite become, and again it's hard to talk about these things as like something that people are aware of or cognizant of, or like you don't want to say accept as a fact of living, but like, you know, had become as much a part of the consciousness as they are now.
Yeah, that's the I think that's a very undervalued episode. But in the first season, Well-Worn Lock, I think, is a very highly undervalued episode as well. I think it's a very disturbing and uncomfortable episode to watch. And, you know, certainly anybody who's wandering in from the X-Files is going to be like, oh, my God, what did I put myself in for? But I think Michelle Joyner is a tremendous actress and does a fantastic job in that. And I was very happy to see her and a parade of other Millennium people show up after the series was canceled in the X-Files.
All right. And then finally, we have a couple of comments from Dave Tobin, actually, who sort of got back very quickly. And he was saying that he's kind of curious about the way the killer hears consent from his victims and how unsettling that is. And he's wondering, like, what the reaction would be today if that was in a sort of a film or TV show. That's kind of interesting because I think it's interesting in that it makes you uncomfortable in a very deliberate and conscious way.
Again, putting things in context, I'm on IMDb right now. That to me seemed a little too much pulled from Dusk Till Dawn, you know, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
The Quentin Tarantino character and Juliette Lewis in the camper, and, you know, he sort of delusionally imagined that she, you know, says you can do whatever you want to me and all that kind of stuff. You're familiar with those scenes? Did you see that movie?
I have, but not in years.
Nobody's seen it in years. Yeah. You know, Quentin Tarantino, I think, had a more of an influence on the X-Files than I think is generally acknowledged. I think that Lazarus, you know, the couple, the bank robbing couple, are straight out of Tarantino.
Natural-born killers, yeah.
Yeah, and Tarantino did a rewrite on Natural Born Killers, didn't he?
He did indeed, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that was just, it was a little too pulpy, but I thought it really worked well in that context. I mean, I think it's more interesting in the context of The Thin White Line than it is in From Dusk to Dawn, which is really just a throwaway movie anyway, so.
The role of Catherine in this episode, which is very, very light. She's sort of like, she's there. Frank is visiting her when the first victim comes in by coincidence, and she sort of plays the role that she plays in a lot of first season episodes where she's sort of comforting him at home. It is that I think this is an episode where it kind of illustrates that they're having a, like, she's used well enough, but as you point out, this is a very macho show, and there's no real sense of Catherine really being a character of equal import to Frank or even Fletcher in this case, in terms of like actual plot mechanics or actual influence.
No, I agree with that. And I'll tell you something. I understand why they didn't do it, you know, because it would just immediately invite X-Files comparisons. But I really think that Frank should have been partnered with a woman from the jump. I think the show really needed that. I think it needed to balance it out, you know, because it's like, you know, X-Files to me, it's like Led Zeppelin, you know, and like Led Zeppelin, you know, you're going to have all those heavy rockers, but you're going to have a lot of different colors and shades and styles and moods, you know, thrown in with it. You know, Millennium to me is more like, you know, it's like a band like, I don't know, like Iron Maiden something, you know, it's all just going to be like very one note, you know, one sense of attack. And the attack, I don't know if you've ever been to a heavy metal concert, but I remember like back in the 80s seeing Motorhead and just like after about two or three songs, I just felt numb. You know what I mean? It's just like the attack was so unrelenting and so monotonous that it loses any sense of power. It just becomes a sort of a static. And I think with Millennium, again, I mean, I don't want to sound overcritical to Millennium because I think it was a great show and I think it was an extraordinary show, particularly for its time. But I think that there were pitfalls and I think that's why it didn't find an audience. I think that if Frank had a female partner, you know, particularly a female partner that might challenge him a little bit, I think that it would have given the show, you know, a much needed balance. But I also understand that the X-Files comparisons would have just been brutal and probably would have overwhelmed the show in that regard as well. So, I mean, I understand the decision-making, but, you know, again, I mean, Emma, this speaks to Clea Scott's strengths as an actress, but I just think that even though the third season is got a lot of problems baked into it, but I think that, you know, Emma Hollis is not one of them. But I got to tell you, by the same token, I felt that the way that Catherine was just completely rewritten in the second season was not good. Was not good writing. And I think, you know, understanding that, you know, Glenn Morgan sort of wanted his girlfriend to sort of have a starring role in place of Catherine, you know, when I sort of understand the backstage dynamics there, it leaves a bit of a sour taste. And it's, you know, it's no dig on Kirsten Cloak, and it's no dig on the Laramie's character, but it's just like, that's a little too Hollywood for me. That's a little too Daryl Zanuck for me. And I think to diminish and to turn Catherine into this sort of shrew, bitter harpy in the second season, you know, that's one of the major criticisms I have of season two.
I suspect we may delve into that when we get to season two. I do have some sort of complicated thoughts on Catherine. But just to wrap up there, Dave also wanted to talk about relating to the Morgan and Wong episodes of season two and also Space Above and Beyond, but we also could have touched on that. And again, the weird supernatural X-Files elements of this. And I think we sort of touched on that when we talked about like Frank's visions and like the show trying to differentiate itself to a certain extent from that. So I think that about wraps it up, unless there's anything else you want to talk about, anything that we've missed in discussing The Thin White Line.
Well, we didn't even get to half my notes.
That's a Patreon exclusive. We'll put that behind the paywall. I shouldn't joke, actually. We do have a paywall, so I shouldn't joke about that. Is there anything actually there? Have a quick look through and see if something sort of jumps out, if there's something that you want to talk about that we haven't sort of covered already.
Well, I the one thing that does stand out to me is the whole aspect of mind control. Because mind control is baked into the X-Files pilot from the get-go. I mean, you know, really, that's what that story is about. And then, of course, in, you know, Deep Throat. I mean, the first two episodes of the X-Files are really about that. And I think that it's fascinating to me that, you know, Carter is trying to differentiate Millennium from the X-Files. But, you know, we see, you know, the second episode, Gehenna, you know, is about mind control. And let me just check my notes here and see what other, you know, arguably the judge, you know, certainly Walkabout, definitely Powers, Principalities,
Thrones, and Dominions.
And then, you know, later on you have Through a Glass Darkly and The Sound of Snow.
Well, I mean, even the season ending two-parter, the series ending two-parter is very much directly about that as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's no question about it. And I did have that listed here, Revisited in Via Dolorosa, Goodbye to All That. So I just think it's interesting that, you know, Carter's fixations, you know.
Echo and reverberate.
Yeah, it's like I'm a very deeply obsessive personality with like really bad OCD. So it's like it takes on to know, and I see it in him as well. And I think that, you know, it's something that his writers definitely picked up on. And it's interesting to me, too, that, you know, it's not explored explicitly until that two-parter that you talk about, which I think is just again, Jose Chung is my favorite episode overall of Millennium. And of course, there's, you know, that's cult mind control as well, right? But if I had to really pick like
a typical episode. A millenniumistic episode, ironically, to use a quote from a non-millenniumistic episode.
Exactly. Via Dolorosa and Goodbye to All That, I just think are phenomenal episodes of television and very dark and deep. And, you know, that's the one thing that I really picked up on the third season is that whoever, I don't know if, you know, how much of an influence Carter had on that entire season was like, all right, let's really tell tales out of school here. You know, let's cover all the bases that we can't really cover in X-Files, you know, without a sort of sci-fi veneer atop them. And we can cover that. But, you know, that really fascinates me because so much of the storylines in the third season are really coming from the deepest quadrants of, you know, the...
As you point out, like, there's a lot of conspiracy theory in there as well. There's a lot of sort of, like, drawing on, like, history and stuff like that. And there's a lot of these little mythological connections as well. Again, like, this feels appropriate that we're sort of coming to the end of the podcast. I would wholeheartedly recommend your reviews of The Secret Sun. You went through episode by episode all of Millennium. But in particular, the third season, which is somewhat perhaps maligned in certain sections of fandom. And I'm going to be honest here, I'm going to lay my cards on the table so I don't seem like I'm being hypocritical or duplicitous here. I'm not a huge fan of the third season overall, but your reviews are fantastic and actually opened my eyes on a number of things. There are a lot of things I like about the third season of Millennium, and a lot of them were my attention was brought to them by your reviews on The Secret Sun as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, I had heard you discuss earlier that you were kind of young when you first watched Millennium, right?
I was indeed. I was very, very young. I was, would have been before I went to college. So it would have been about 15 ish. Yeah.
Millennium came on when I was 29. No, I was actually 30 at the time. So, you know, I had a little bit more
experience.
A little bit longer in the tooth. Yeah. I had a little bit more experience under my belt. And actually, I didn't watch season three at all. Because I'd watched season two when it was rerun on Sci-Fi here. But I sort of was scared off by season three by all the things that I was reading on the internet. And then I went back and watched it, and I was like,
"What were these people watching?"
Oh my goodness! Somebody is letting all the secrets out of the cookie jar with this show. Boy, I'll tell you something. Somebody was doing some really, really deep research. And again, it felt to me like Carter was just letting loose all the,
as you point out, all the stuff that you couldn't get away with on the X-Files without having to put aliens in them.
Exactly. Particularly an episode like Collateral Damage
with Jane Marsters, isn't it? He's a guest star in
yes.
there.
Yes. Yes.
Sweeps episode, if I recall, yeah.
But yeah, that was really coming from a lot of things that I was reading in a magazine called Covert Action Quarterly. And it was this newsletter that was written by a former intelligence people and had a lot of interesting things to say about the Gulf War and all that kind of thing. When I saw that on that episode, I'm like, you got to be friggin' kidding me. I was just like, I couldn't believe it. And it's probably something that if it was a higher rated show that they never could have gotten away with. But like the whole thing with the remote viewing and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I mean, all that stuff just really blew me away because the character in Exegesis, I forget his name. I think it's Don Cody. I actually personally know the guy that's based on because I'd met him, the guy who ran the remote viewing program at Stanford Research Interview.
But cool. So I think that about wraps it up. But Chris, if people are looking to get a bit more sort of Chris Knowles in their lives, where can they find you online?
My first novel is getting ready to be published or printed because
nice.
I'm self-publishing because I don't think that any publisher would know what to do with it. But I'm very excited about it. It's I think it's something that people who like X-Files and Millennium are going to grok onto right away. It covers a lot of those bases. I'm a big proponent of the dance with the one that brung you concept. And so I'm really dealing with a lot of things that people would expect me to be dealing with in a fictional context and drawing on some personal history and things like that. So the book is going to be called, he will actually be up by the time this airs.
Oh, great.
It's going to be called, or it is called, He Will Live Up in the Sky. And I'm probably going to do that through Amazon.
Perfect. So it'll be available from Amazon and presumably other online retailers or just exclusively through there. But yeah, so check it out. It's, what's it called again? It's
He Will Live Up in the Sky.
Cool. Perfect. So check that out. Make sure to check that out. Also, you run the Secret Sun blog as well, and you're online on Twitter as well, at the Secret Sun as well.
Yeah, I haven't been blogging so much anymore because I'm kind of, to be honest with you, I have a bit of writer's block. So maybe by the time this goes live, I will have overcome that. But I've been struggling with writer's block on the blog, unfortunately.
All right. You can follow me at Darren_Mooney. I co-host another podcast called The 250, where we talk about the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. I also write at The Movie Blog with a 0 instead of an O in movie because I didn't get there quick enough, much like watching Millennium, apparently. So please check those out. I've done reviews of every episode of Millennium and every episode of The X-Files on there as well. So if you are interested in checking some of those out, please feel free to do so. Otherwise, feel free to hit me up online. I'm always happy to talk about this sort of stuff. In terms of the podcast, you can follow the podcast online at The Time Is Now Pod on Twitter, which you can find on Facebook with a quick Google as well, where there's a community there sort of developing and people want to talk about it. It's also part of a larger podcast network. You probably heard this at the start, which is We Made This, which includes stuff like the X-Cast as well. So there's a wealth of content on there for people who are sort of interested in this sort of thing. Anyway, take it easy. We'll be back next week. We won't be back next week, but somebody will be back next week. But until then, remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advanced access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.